From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a Supreme Court decision raises up the experiences of a transgender woman from Michigan.
We do exist. We've always been here. And we always will be here, regardless of what they choose.
The voice of Amy Stevens, vindicated posthumously by today's ruling.
This case meant so much to her. Not for herself, but for her wanting to make a positive difference in the lives of other transgender people.
Later in the hour, more on the court's decision and what it means. Protests in the streets have sent many Americans in search of books on race and racism. We'll check in today with one bookstore about the desire for more material.
I bought a whole bunch of books wholesale, and I was on 7 Mile, and those books just went, like, in a matter of hours. I said, wow, I like this.
Those stories and more coming up on today's episode of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, Black-owned bookstores around the country are flooded with orders. We'll hear from an Ypsilanti store owner about what business has been like on his street between the COVID shutdown and widespread protests over policing and use of force.
I mean, business has been booming. I could truly say business has truly been booming. So I once heard a man said, it's not about the storm, it's about how you set your sail. That website was our sail.
But first, the U.S. Supreme Court this morning issued a landmark decision that extended workplace civil rights protections to LGBTQ people. One of the cases considered in the arguments was that of Amy Stevens, a transgender woman who was fired from her job at a funeral home after telling her boss she was transgender and transitioning to living as a woman. Amy Stevens died just a couple of weeks ago after a prolonged period of declining health and kidney failure. Stateside spoke with Amy last fall about her case. Let's listen to her in her own words, describing what was at stake.
The fact that an LGBTQ person can be fired from their job, they can be denied housing, any number of things, is not right. We're not asking for anything special. We just want the same basic human rights that everybody else has. And so far, we don't have those. We've been denied, and the way things appear, they would like to just erase us altogether, saying that we don't exist. But we do exist. We've always been here. And we always will be here, regardless of what they choose.
That's Amy Stevens speaking with Stateside in 2019. Jay Kaplan is a staff attorney for the LGBT Project at the ACLU of Michigan, which represented Amy Stevens. Jay Kaplan, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Good to be here.
How would you characterize the scale and scope of this decision?
This is huge. This is really a historic decision. The court has reaffirmed many lower federal court decisions that have held that transgender people are protected against discrimination under federal civil rights laws that prohibit sex discrimination. They've also said that it includes gay and lesbian people. And they've done so not just based on facts that talk about, you know, various statements that would be characterized as gender stereotyping, but they've said that inherently gay and lesbian people, transgender people, when you discriminate against them, you're doing it because of sex. Sex is inherently the reason behind that, the sex that was assigned to them at birth, because they don't look or act or love the way the employer thinks that they should, and that this is prohibited discrimination.
The Supreme Court is generally perceived as a more conservative body than it was in 2015 when it ruled in favor of gay marriage. Were you surprised that the court found in your favor on this case?
Pleasantly pleased with the response. I think the fact that it's a 6-3 decision, I think that's very significant. And you had Justice Gorsuch, who's known as a conservative justice, writing the majority opinion. But I think you also have to take into mind that the argument that was made before the court would probably be characterized as a conservative one or a textualist approach. What does sex mean? under civil rights laws. And if you apply our understanding of what sex means and how the court has interpreted that in various cases in involving different forms of sex discrimination, this is a logical outcome. And Justice Gorsuch even said during the oral arguments, yeah, you know, just looking at the text itself, it's pretty clear to me this is sex discrimination. So we're very, very happy with this outcome. We think, though, it didn't necessarily have to take a progressive court or what they would term as a liberal court to reach this result, that even if you consider yourself to be a conservative jurist and you just look at the language itself, that clearly Amy was fired and Don Zarda was fired and Gerald Bostic were fired from their jobs because of sex.
There was some discussion by both the majority and the dissenting opinions about the sort of the social impact of providing Title VII coverage. Could you break down in layperson's terms what they're talking about there?
Title VII is the federal civil rights law that prohibits discrimination in employment on the basis of sex. And so what the court has done today is said that when you discriminate against a gay or lesbian person or a transgender person, you are discriminating in employment, you are discriminating against them on the basis of sex, which violates Title VII.
As I mentioned, Amy Stevens, who you represented in this case and worked with for years, died last month. What was your reaction when you heard that the court had ruled in her favor?
Very bittersweet. My heart was so full about the opinion. But also it was devastating that Amy's not here. This case meant so much to her, not for herself, but for her wanting to make a positive difference in the lives of other transgender people. And you mentioned your introduction about all the health problems she experienced, but she always wanted to be there to tell her story, to be the spokesperson for this case. And I spoke with Amy less than 2 weeks before she passed away. And she said that her one wish was that she would live long enough to be able to read this opinion. And I'm so sad and so sorry that she's not here today. I want to thank her because we do owe it all to her for her courage and her bravery to stand up and to redress the wrong that was done to her and the wrong that has been done to so many transgender people.
I never met her, but it sounded like from the audio that we just played that she did understand the significance of this case for the future of protections of LGBTQ people in this country. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. And, you know, I've spoken about this a few times. Her job meant so much to her. That was her purpose in life, to try to help people as a funeral director, as an embalmer. And when that purpose was taken away from her, that was devastating. But I like to believe that she found another purpose towards the end of her life as the face of this case and telling her story, being involved, you know, going public, telling her story, sharing her life in order to benefit others in the transgender community. That responsibility meant so much to her. It was so meaningful. The day before the oral arguments, before the Supreme Court, Amy did back-to-back interviews, probably about 10 of them. And she did it until she got so sick, she had to go back to her room and lay down. But she was determined to do everything she could in her unfortunate short lifetime to try to make a better world for our community. And we will be forever grateful for her and for her legacy.
Just over the weekend, the Trump administration announced it's rolling back protections for transgender people in medical settings. And the rationale there was that the prohibition against sex discrimination in the Affordable Care Act did not apply to transgender identity. Do you think that today's decision could have a wider impact beyond workplace protections?
Absolutely. I think the rationale that the court uses and how they explain that this is sex discrimination, I think that can be applied to areas of public accommodations, to education, to housing. And I hope we'll be able to use this decision as that vehicle to challenge those other discriminatory practices. So I think in essence, what the court said today renders the logic behind what the Trump administration did null and void.
Talk to us a little bit about the work that you see still remaining in terms of protecting LGBTQ people for housing, for healthcare, or maybe for education.
Well, we still have to challenge those practices because it definitely occurs. We know that transgender people, a large percentage of them, spend some certain time in their life experiencing homelessness because of housing discrimination. We know the problems in terms of trying to access health care and health insurance coverage, and just problems with, you know, sometimes in a restaurant or maybe a shopping mall for transgender people. We know that there's issues regarding with education, being able to use restrooms in accordance with gender identity. So we still have a way to go. And I think our work is not done in the sense we still need to pass the Equality Act, the federal law that makes it clear that that sex includes sexual orientation and gender identity in areas like public accommodation. And we need to amend our state civil rights laws to have the explicit terms sexual orientation and gender identity. So that's not subject to judicial interpretation as to whether or not LGBT people are to be afforded the same dignity and same rights as other people. So we still need to have that happen.
In what you have read of the decision, are there specific areas of the law that you think have been opened up by the language that the majority used?
Well, I think the majority opinion talks about compassionate language about the lives of these individual people, Don Zarda, Gerald Bostic, Amy Stevens, and tells a little bit about their story. But I think it's the analysis explaining why this is sex discrimination. And whenever that's taken into consideration into the discriminatory act, that's prohibited. And I think that's a basis that we certainly can argue in other areas, in the areas of education, in the areas of housing, and certainly in public accommodations.
Jay Kaplan is staff attorney at the ACLU of Michigan, and he represented Amy Stevens in the case that was decided today. Jay, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Later this hour, we remember Ann Arbor's Kathy Kozachenko, the first openly gay person to win an election in America.
She didn't really understand that she was going to be the first person in the United States, possibly the world, that ran for public office as a person who was out.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. This is Pride Month, a time when we remember people on the forefront of LGBTQ history. There was a time in the 1970s, as riots were underway at the Stonewall Inn in New York's Greenwich Village, when Michigan towns were on the vanguard of public opinion and the fight for civil rights. East Lansing was among the first cities in the country to extend civil rights protections to gay men and lesbians. Ann Arbor was on the cusp of having three gay people in city elected office. And the name of one young woman from Plymouth was about to be propelled into the ranks of folks like Harvey Milk and Barney Frank. Jillian Reese is curator of exhibits at the Michigan History Center, and she joins us now. Jillian, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It is not as well known as, say, the Harvey Milk story, but there was a time in the 1970s when Ann Arbor was on the vanguard of representation in government. Can you tell us a little bit about what was going on in 1974?
Yes, we're celebrating Pride Month in June, and we use June because this was the month that had the uprising at the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village, New York City. Although that event happened in one neighborhood in New York, the ripple effect was really felt around the country. And so, you know, that happened in 1969, and pretty quickly in 1970, 1971, you start seeing activism around LGBTQ rights in Detroit and Ann Arbor. On the Detroit end, the activism tended to be a little bit more bohemian. It was really arising out of working class communities, mainly African-American working class communities. And then in Ann Arbor, you sort of saw at the same time a more, I would say, traditional and sort of what we think of around queer activism today, meaning that they were really focused on legal rights of the LGBTQ community. And so you start seeing a group of folks associated with the University of Michigan that are really pushing the bounds as to how municipalities and governments can protect the rights of all citizens in their community.
And Jillian, given the huge sea change that's gone on in the culture since then, maybe it's important to talk about exactly what legal rights they were fighting for.
Yeah, so up until the Stonewall Uprising, you know, being out and being someone who not only your friends and your family might know was gay or trans, but being out to your employer, to just being out publicly was exceptionally rare.
Yeah.
And we see a lot of these consequences for being out today. But even more so before Stonewall, you could lose your job, you could lose your housing, or you could lose your life. You know, violence against queer people was very, very regular and was actually dictated by law. So in many places in the United States, including the federal government, it was a fireable offense to be known as gay. And so what you start seeing after Stonewall, the LGBTQ community really trying to say, we are here and we aren't going anywhere. And a way to do that was to publicly come out.
So how did Ann Arbor react?
So in Ann Arbor, they had passed a non-discrimination ordinance. And the non-discrimination ordinance that the City Council of Ann Arbor had passed was something that even today is very rare. So not only did it include race and gender and religion affiliation, nationality, but it also included sexual orientation and now includes gender identity also. It was something that was passed and sort of given protections in housing from employment discrimination, but also said the LGBT community should be protected in public spaces so that the city of Ann Arbor actually had an obligation to protect citizens from violence if they were out and about. And after that ordinance was passed, two city council members were giving an impassioned speech trying to convince the Ann Arbor police chief to enforce this new non-discrimination law. And they came out. That was Jerry DeGreck and Nancy Wexler.
And was there some question whether the chief was going to enforce this?
Yes. You know, it was very radical. You know, and we didn't really have any sort of hate crime legislation. The idea of violence that was motivated by some sort of hatred or bias towards a group of people was the main one that would probably have resonated with people in 1970 would have been race-based violence, especially considering the civil rights movement of the mid-century, the focus on sort of the violence that the Black community had faced. But not many people were talking about other types of identity-based violence, like violence against people who were queer or presented as not the traditional sort of heterosexual couple. You know, the police, I think even today, there are instances of people saying, you know, I don't know how to say this in a way that's articulate for the radio, but, you know, they might blame self-defense as a motivator towards violence against individuals. Mm-hmm. And a lot of enforcement of particularly laws like hate crime laws is up to law enforcement officials. So I think that they were trying to show, okay, I am a human being and I'm a citizen and I pay taxes and I should be protected from worrying about if I'm going to get beaten up when I'm out with
my significant other or my friends. And so coming out was a way of humanizing the individual and saying that many LGBTQ people live in the dark as a way to protect themselves. And that shouldn't have to be the case. And that the act of coming out, of proclaiming that you are gay or trans, forces people to sort of see the individual behind some of these non-discrimination protections.
Now, around this time, a person named Kathy Kozachenko comes on the scene. Can you explain how she became involved in politics in Ann Arbor?
Yeah, so Kathy was a student at U of M. She graduated from high school in Plymouth, and by her own account, her family was conservative. And when she got to U of M, she, you know, started getting involved in student politics. There was an incredible almost decade of activity at the University of Michigan around student activism. And you started to see students not only organizing towards anti-racism or anti-war activism, but also activism around the treatment of the LGBTQ community. So she joined a party, a radical left third party called the Human Rights Party. And they had a platform that was very inclusive of very many things. They were anti-war. They talked about redlining. They talked about anti-racism. But one of the things that they also spoke out about was against discrimination and violence against gay and trans people. And so she joined them, and they wanted her to run for city council. They asked her, would you be willing to run as an out lesbian and have that as a part of your identity as a candidate? And she just said, sure. I think her reminiscences about this time was that she didn't really understand that she was going to be the first person in the United States, possibly the world, that ran for public office as a person who was out. And two of the members of the city council had already come out about 6 months before in a meeting, but she would be the first that, while she's running for election.
Yeah. It's not hard to see how that was a very different matter at the time.
Yes.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jillian Reese. She's curator of exhibits at the Michigan History Center. And we're talking about Michigan's vanguard candidates in LGBTQ representation in local government. So she won. What do we know about what kind of coalition of voters got behind her?
Yeah, so she was in a ward that was known for being a little bit more radical. It's an area of Ann Arbor that still today has a lot of residents who are students at U of M. But it also had, at the time, some working class communities. And, I think it's important to recognize that there is a different history with LGBT communities within working class communities. They tended to be a little bit more accepting and open. But she did. She won her election by about 52 votes. And despite the fact that her opponents really tried to drill down to her sexual orientation, a lot of the reports at the time didn't even talk about that when she got elected.
Interesting.
There's a New York Times article about the election, and they cared more about the ordinance that passed decriminalizing cannabis than they did that this was possibly the first out candidate to win an election.
Well, Jillian, do you think it's possible that, like, maybe the papers just didn't even want to touch the subject?
Yeah, I think that, there were probably well-meaning reporters that knew that being out could mean that you could lose your housing, that you could lose your job, you could lose your life. But I also think this goes to the importance of having representation within journalism. You know, maybe to a straight journalist in 1974, when she won election, it wasn't really that big of a deal, or it wasn't something that they even noticed. Whereas maybe if you had more representation from the LGBT community, that would have been something that they would really be pointing to as something that was equaling progress since the Stonewall uprising.
I believe that Kathy Kosachenko, when her term on council was over, just got out of politics, and then she went on and to leave the state, did she not?
Yes, she left Michigan after she graduated from U of M and actually moved to Brooklyn, where she continued to be involved in not only queer activism, but also anti-racism and anti-war activism in Brooklyn. You know, she was someone who was involved in sort of like activism around denuclearization.
Yeah.
Then she moved to Pittsburgh and ended up meeting her wife, and then had a son, and ended up sort of settling down into a more sort of 9-to-5 lifestyle. And that was really when she stopped talking about her own activism, particularly around LGBTQ issues, because although in 1974 she was able to get elected to the Ann Arbor City Council, in the 1980s there was a big backlash against the gay liberation movement. And she felt, again, she needed to sort of hide parts of her identity in order to protect her job and her family.
What should we take away from the fact that Kathy Kosachenko kind of disappeared after her time on council in Ann Arbor?
You know, I think we should really remember not to sort of boil down people to one identity marker. People are multifaceted, and also that a lot of ordinary people make extraordinary things happen. I said it before, I'll say it again, Kathy refers to herself as a candidate who just happened to be a lesbian. And in all the interviews I've ever read with her, that's really how she sees herself. She never even told her son about her place in history, because she just sees herself as an ordinary person. And I find that really inspiring, you know, particularly in a time when there are so many just everyday people who are either entering traditional politics or going out and protesting, that ordinary people can also make their voice be heard, that you don't have to be a full-time activist to impact the history of the United States.
Jillian, could we say that Kathy Kosachenko was the beginning of a watershed of representation in political circles in America?
Yeah, there's no doubt that between 1974 and today that we've made a lot of progress. But today, there are only 855 out LGBTQ people that hold political office in the United States.
In the entire country.
In the entire country. And that only makes up about 0.17% of all elected officials, while, you know, some estimates of the LGBT community is that it's about 10% of our population, if not more. And so we're really far away from equal representation. And I think that, you know, we should be very excited about the fact we had our first out presidential candidate in this last Democratic primary, but we still have a long way to go before we see sort of equal representation in a lot of different areas, not just politics.
Jillian Reese is curator of exhibits at the Michigan History Center. Jillian, thanks again.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to hear your stories for Pride Month, either how you're marking this time or maybe stories of the trailblazers that you know. You can email us at stateside@michiganradio.org. You're always welcome to post comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page. And you can also throw us a line on Twitter. There's a lot going on right now, from the Supreme Court case to just whatever you're seeing on your block. Our handle on Twitter is @StatesideRadio. We're looking forward to hearing from you. Up next, a Black-owned bookstore in Washtenaw County reports an increase in sales as people search for Black history and political theory.
When you come to the store, brick and mortar, our little 900-square-foot brick, I guarantee you when you come out, you'll have an experience that you'll never forget.
He also says he's been crazy busy filling online orders for those who choose not to or cannot come to the storefront. We'll meet him in just a second and find out what's flying off the shelves. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Protests against police brutality all across the country have caused many Americans to look inward and continue their education about systemic racism in America. Many are doing so through books, and where better to get those books than from Black-owned bookstores? We wanted to talk to a much-loved Ypsilanti storefront, Blackstone Bookstore and Cultural Center. And this is what we mean by cultural center. It's the kind of place where you might stop in to pick up a well-known title by James Baldwin or seek out a rare out-of-print text from a well-regarded academic. In less physically distant times, you might also stop by for Story Hour from the city's Black Men Read series, in which guys sit down to tell stories to children featuring characters they can relate to. Husband and wife Kip and Athena Johnson are part of the ownership team for Blackstone. We called them up to get recommendations and hear their story. We'll hear from Kip first. Kip Johnson, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, glad to be here.
So Blackstone is not just a place to buy books, but as the name suggests, it's also a cultural center. Could you tell us a little bit about what that means?
You know, Blackstone's, you know, when we all start, well, let me tell you my love for bookstores in general. I used to love going down to the Shrine of the Black Madonna, right?
Mm-hmm.
Down in the city, it was a bookstore. And it was just, it was much more than the bookstore. It was just the ambiance of the place. It was an experience that I received every time we went down there. And it was just a great feel of culture and a place where I felt like I belonged. And I just said, man, it would so be wonderful if I can open up a spot down in Washtenaw County, we can have the same thing. It's always been my dream to open one up, and God willing, you know, since 2013, my partner Carlos and my beautiful wife and his wife Andrea, we made that happen.
Do you mind telling us the story of how you got the place opened?
yeah. Well, actually, I'm a Ford. I work for Ford Motor Company. I started with Ford in 06. And I went through got laid off for 2 years. So, you know, down in the streets of Detroit, I was interested in, you know, I was a peddler. I used to sell incense oils and whatnot here and there. And I used to sell books all over the place. And so I remember buying a box of books. I think there was I bought a whole bunch of books wholesale, and I was on 7 Mile, and those books just went in a matter of hours. And I said, wow, I like this. I said, people buying books, they was buying books more than they were buying incense. And so I said, man, you know, it'd be wonderful if I can get this started, man, somewhere in the Washtenaw County area. So that box of books became 2 boxes of books, and 2 boxes of books became 4 boxes of books. And next thing you know, the dream came. But as far as like, you know, as Blackstones in general, my wife was, she used to go back and forth to this party store, gas station in Ypsilanti. And that's where she met this brother named Carlos, Carlos Franklin. And she was explaining to him that I was interested in opening a bookstore myself. You know, that my husband's trying to open up a bookstore. My wife can tell you, so she's right here.
So I myself, I'm always driving everywhere. I'm a musician, so I'm always driving everywhere. And so I'm here in Washtenaw County. And so when I walked in, when I went to this gas station and I saw Carlos running, there were books at the gas station, which that was a first for me at the time. I'm like, huh, okay. And I saw the type of books that he was selling. They were more like urban love novels and what have you. And so I chatted with him for a minute. I said, you know what? You need to meet my husband. I said, because you're already running a business and he's trying to start one, and you guys are both, you know, doing the book thing. So let's set up a meeting to see maybe if we can make this
collab,
come and collab
collaboration.
Just to see.
Yeah, since then, we've been rocking ever since.
Right. You know, given that the place has become a spot that people know in Ypsilanti, what has business been like for you since the pandemic struck?
Before it started, we were thriving at a point. People were coming by and, you know, but I'm going to be honest with you. People want to know. People are really hungry for information. So where do people go? They either go to the internet or they look for a book. They look for information. So, and that's the whole thing about Blackstones. We're a source of information. We're a hub for information. Because it's a lot of your activists, the first place they come, they'll come to the bookstore. And they give us an update on what's going on. It's kind of like, you know, putting your ears to the ground and getting an understanding of what's going on in the neighborhood. But before, this pandemic hit, we were thriving. But Carlos ended up setting up our first website, Blackstone Bookstore website. And from that website, I mean, business has been booming. I could truly say business has truly been booming. So, you know, I once heard a man said, it's not about the storm, it's about how you set your sail. And I could truly say that website was our sail. And we've just been floating away. And we really appreciate the community. And it's actually been beautiful. Wow. It's kind of like actually bittersweet because of the situation we've been dealing with in this country. But, you know, yeah, we're thriving.
What kinds of titles are people asking for right now?
Books like New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander.
The Water Dancer.
Yeah, The Water Dancer.
T.E.C. Coates.
White Fragility.
So you want to know about race?
You want to know about race, that's the hot one right now.
Right.
And it's really hard to find. Well, actually, it's not hard to find. It's just like really in backward. White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. And
How to Be Anti-Racist
with Abram X. Kendi. And Me and White Supremacy. So those books right there, those are the top 10 books that's really bumping right now. So
as well as our children's section.
Yeah, and our children's sections.
A lot of times when people go to a bookseller, they're looking obviously for a good read or, you know, good information. But they're also looking to connect. What do you feel like Blackstone has to offer? You know, there's so many options. And, you know, a lot of people, they'll just jump online and they'll look for where a title can be found, you know, least expensive. And a lot of times that leads them to Amazon or, you know, some other mass market bookseller. What do you feel like Blackstone has to offer that other booksellers can't really match?
Wow. Blackstones, I will tell you, we're personable. And the first thing I wanted to do when we, Carlos and I, and my wife and Andrea, we wanted to be real personal with our customer base. One thing about in any business that you go into is about relationships. A lot of bookstores and a lot of businesses, it's hard to set that foundation, is building relationships. See, you can come in and you can spend a dollar here and there, but to build a relationship, that's forever. That's forever. I want to know how your family doing. How are you doing? How your children doing? How work going? And it's like a lot of different places, such as Barnes and Nobles or, you know, different places, you know, a lot of your top places or even Amazon. They really don't get too personal. I mean, you can't get personal on Amazon, can you? Yeah. You know, so Blackstone's, you know, when you come to the store or brick and mortar, our little 900 square foot brick edifice that we have downtown 214 West Michigan Ave, I guarantee you when you come out, you'll have an experience that you'll never forget.
Just piggybacking on what Kip said, I just co-sign on that. And me just being a people person myself, you know, I'm just like, what do you need? You know, and we specialize, we try our best to do like the hard to find reads, the reads that are out of print. That's what we that's another extra step that Absolutely. We take. Kip is really good at finding that. Like I said, Kip and Carlos, they all have their own, you know, unique strengths. And one of Kip's tends to be that, you know.
Oh, I'm a bloodhound.
He's a bloodhound on finding books that are out of print or hard to find. And people are, you know, surprising. They are willing to pay $100, $200, or $400 for a book.
Wow.
So we like to share that with them.
My favorite people to ask for reading recommendations are booksellers because there's that relationship. I wanted to ask both of you if there are books that you found yourself going back to in the past few weeks and months that have been so difficult. Not that you've had that much discretionary time for reading with keeping the shop going. But I don't know. Kip, do you want to start? Maybe tell us about some books that, you know, that have been meaningful reads to you right now in this moment.
Oh, wow. I could truly say I can always go back to Malcolm X's autobiography. That's a classic. As well as Superman the Man by J.A. Rogers, I'm sorry. And then I always find myself going back to the children's book of Keats.
Ezra Keats,
man. Ezra Keats, we used to go back to there.
The Snowy Day.
Yep. The Snowy Day.
Peter's Chair.
Sometimes you got to get out the seriousness of sometimes, man, to take, go back down memory lane when you was like, had your thumb in your mouth.
Right. Hey, can we go back a minute to Superman to Man? I just, Kip, I just went ahead and looked it up. I did not know the title, but this is a 1917 novel by Joel Augustus Rogers. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the book?
Yeah. Actually, it's about a coachman during that time. And it's a fictional novel that this brother wrote. And it's a conversation that goes on between the coachman, which was African American, and a senator, a white senator. So it's a conversation on race through the whole book, but it's a lot of I should say the senator was very racist, but and didn't know the historical. Well, he, like I said, they both just first time meeting each other, engaging each other, and pretty much the coachman was well-schooled, traveled all around the world. At this time, that was very uncommon for an African-American man. And he was very humble, but yet and still the senator was coming up, was talking about, well, you know, I mean, they was having a heavy conversation on race, talking about the black man's inferiority. But this brother actually flips it on him and was talking about all the great accomplishments of the African-American and the African alone throughout the world, all the accomplishments throughout the world. And put at the end of the book, I'm not going to tell you what happened in the book, but it's a very great read. It's a very great read, especially coming up in that time.
And probably something that did not appear on a lot of reading lists unless you went to an HBC, I suppose.
Probably. Actually, my son's going through HBCU school. He's going to Hampton University. Got a full ride. I got to put that in.
Oh, wow. Again, mom and dad win.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Can I, I'm still so in awe that you two have been able to keep the store going amid your other, I guess I'll call them day jobs.
Yes.
How have you been able to keep things going at the store?
Robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yep.
Tag teaming. It's Carlos is in and out. Athena is in and out. I'm driving back and forth from Lima, Ohio, because I work for it. I transferred to Lima, Ohio.
Oh, wow.
So I'm back and forth up on that 75 highway.
What is that, a 2-hour commute?
Yeah. Yes. 2 hours.
2 hours.
Yep. So he, we make it work, I tell you. So like I said, whenever, like a wife will, she'll have her husband's back, in his absence. This technology allows us to, number one, Zoom and share screens so we can FaceTime each other if I have any questions. But, Carlos is there. You'll see his face mostly during the week and the first half of the day. And the second half of the day, I'll come in and run things.
Like I said, his wife, Andrea, is filling in orders.
Yeah.
Our kids and our children are in there filling in orders and packing the orders out and sending them out the next day. So it's a family effort.
Well, Kip and Athena, we really appreciate all your work over the years, and especially given everything else that's going on, the fact that you took some time to talk to us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for allowing us to come on your platform and be able to spread the word. And we wish you and your family all the best in the world.
The same to you. Kip and Athena Johnson are the co-founders and co-owners of Blackstone Bookstore and Cultural Center in Ypsilanti. Let's move over to one of the poets that you might seek out at a store like Blackstone. Esperanza Cintron is an Afro-Latina poet and author who works in Detroit. Her poems explore race, ethnicity, gender, and what it means to live in the city. We asked her recently to share some work with us. Let's listen.
Yo soy Latina Negra, which means I'm a Black Latin. And there are so many of us. People don't think about the Afro-Latin population. We have a large Puerto Rican, Cuban, Nicaraguan population here in Detroit. A lot of them, of course, live in Southwest Detroit. But, I live in Lafayette Park. But a lot of people don't think about that, because if you think about some of the very famous Afro-Latin poets, Nicolas Guillen, the Cuban poet, Tato Laviera, Pedro Pietri, these are all Afro-Latins. But a lot of people don't think of, Latinos as being Black, but, there were African slaves in the islands. And as Puerto Ricans have American citizenship. So we can go and come to the mainland freely. A lot of my family, of course, settled in New York, Brooklyn, until now, they're being outpriced by gentrification. So they're moving to Long Island and to Rhode Island and so forth. But I'm still here in Detroit, as are many other Afro-Latinos. Okay, this is from my first book, because, in the first book, which came out in 2005, is called Chocolate City Latina. I was exploring all of that. Each book, takes on a different phase of my life. But this one is called Chocolate City Latina, and I was only going to read the first portion of it. There are two sections, but the first portion sets up the transition, from the island to the city. Okay. Daddy taught me to merengue when I was 3. The rhythms blurred with a Motown doo-wop, a salsa, and fingertips cacophony. Instead of marin, there was Coleman's slant-eyed, cocky grin and the low-down rumble of his African laced with black-bottom cadence, covering the rolling R's and labia-loaded lengua de boricua. Swallowed whole, como un pez, done backstroke through the Bermuda Triangle, grazed the Hudson Bay, and breaststroked around the Great Lakes. To sun on the banks of the Detroit River, the lure still caught in my uvula, pulling me forward in a temptation strut, a supreme swivel, hips loose and mouth open, a wet note caught and reeled in, doo-wah, doo-wop, the hesitant swish and clip of the serrated gourd and scraper surged the beat on, the undercurrent, a cupped palm, splayed fingers pounding the tight skin of a tall drum like the hard snap of young Black men's fingers in front of corner stores on 12th Street before the fires. Doo-wah, doo-wop, swish, a canto of decades of overcoming, covered by smoldering bushes and bumbling fords who yielded blackened hulls and ghosts that sing falsetto as each building is razed to open space, hosts to phantom teepees, and red women like the Taino squat before huge mortars grinding grain, their translucent figures mingled with oil drum fires, and old young men in rags who warm their calloused hands over acrid smoke.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.